This is Audible.
Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fall on Your Knees by Anne-Marie MacDonald. Read by Cassandra Campbell. Why canst thou not always be a good lass, Cathy? Why cannot you always be a good man, Father? Wuthering Heights. Silent Pictures. They're all dead now. Here's a picture of the town where they lived, New Waterford. It's a night bright with the moon. Imagine you are looking down from the height of a church steeple onto the vivid gradations of light and shadow that make the picture. A small mining town near cutaway cliffs that curve over narrow rock beaches below, where the silver sea rolls and rolls, flattering the moon. Not many trees, thin grass, the silhouette of a colliery, iron tower against a slim pewter sky with cables and supports sloping at 45-degree angles to the ground. Railway tracks that stretch only a short distance from the base of a gorgeous high slant of glinting coal toward an archway in the earth where the tracks slope in and down and disappear. And spreading away from the collieries and coal heaps are the peaked roofs of the miners' houses, built row upon row by the coal company. Company houses. Company town. Look down over the street where they lived. Water Street. An avenue of packed dust and scattered stones that leads out past the edge of town to where the wide, keeling graveyard overlooks the ocean. That sighing sound is just the sea. Here's a picture of their house as it was then. White wood frame with the covered veranda. It's big compared to the miners' houses. There's a piano in the front room. In the back is the kitchen where Mama died. Here's a picture of her the day she died. She had a stroke while cleaning the oven, which is how the doctor put it. Of course, you can't see her face for the oven, but you can see where she had her stockings rolled down for housework, and although this is a black-and-white picture, her house dress actually is black, since she was in mourning for Kathleen at the time, as well as Ambrose. You can't tell from this picture, but Mama couldn't speak English very well. Mercedes found her like that, half in, half out of the oven, like the witch in Hansel and Gretel. What did she plan to cook that day? When Mama died, all the eggs in the pantry went bad. They must have, because you could smell that sulfur smell all the way down Water Street. So that's the house at 191 Water Street, New Waterford, Cape Breton Island, in the far eastern province of Nova Scotia, Canada. And that's Ma on the day she died, June 23rd, 1919. Here's a picture of Daddy. He's not dead, he's asleep. You see that armchair he's in? That's the pale green wingback. His hair is braided. That's not an ethnic custom. They were only ethnic on Mama's side. Those are braids that Lily put in his hair while he was asleep. There are no pictures of Ambrose. There wasn't time for that. Here's a picture of his crib, still warm. Other Lily is in limbo. She lived a day, then died before she could be baptized, and went straight to limbo along with all the other unbaptized babies and the good heathens. They don't suffer. They just sort of hang there effortlessly and unaware. Jesus is known to have gone into limbo occasionally and taken a particularly good heathen out of it and up to heaven, so it is possible. Otherwise, that's why this picture of Other Lily is a white blank. Don't worry, Ambrose was baptized. Here's one of Mercedes. That opal rosary of hers was basically priceless. An opal rosary, can you imagine? She kept it pinned to the inside of her brassiere, over her heart, at all times when she wasn't using it, partly for divine protection, partly out of the convenience of never being without the means to say a quick decade of the beads when the spirit moved her, which was often. Although, as Mercedes liked to point out, you can say the rosary with any objects at hand if you find yourself in need of a prayer but without your beads. For example, you can say it with pebbles or breadcrumbs. Francis wanted to know, could you say the rosary with cigarette butts? The answer was yes, if you're pure at heart. With mouse turds, with someone's freckles, the dots in a newspaper photograph of Harry Houdini. That's enough, Francis. In any case, this is a picture of Mercedes, holding her opal rosary with one finger raised and pressed against her lips. She's saying, shh, shh. And this is Francis. But wait, she's not in it yet. This one is a moving picture. It was taken at night, behind the house. There is the creek, flowing black and shiny between its narrow banks. And there is the garden on the other side. Imagine you can hear the creek trickling, like a girl telling a secret in a language so much like our own. A still night. A midnight clear. It's only fair to tell you that a neighbor once saw the dismembered image of his son in this creek, only to learn upon his arrival home for supper that his son had been crushed to death by a fall of stone in number 12 mine. But tonight the surface of the creek is merely as nature made it. And certainly it's odd, but not at all supernatural to see the surface break, and a real live, soaked and shivering girl rise up from the water and stare straight at us. Or at someone just behind us. Francis. What's she doing in the middle of the creek in the middle of the night? And what's she hugging to her chest with her chicken skinny arms? A dark, wet bundle. Did it stir just now? What are you doing, Francis? But even if she were to answer, we wouldn't know what she was saying, because although this is a moving picture, it is also a silent one. All the pictures of Kathleen were destroyed, all except one, and it's been put away. Kathleen sang so beautifully that God wanted her to sing for him in heaven with his choir of angels. So he took her. Book 1. The Garden. To Seek His Fortune. A long time ago, before you were born, there lived a family called Piper on Cape Breton Island. The daddy, James Piper, managed to stay out of the coal mines most of his life, for it had been his mother's great fear that he would grow up and enter the pit. She had taught him to read the classics, to play piano, and to expect something finer in spite of everything, and that was what James wanted for his own children. James's mother came from Wreck Cove, the daughter of a prosperous boat builder. James's father was a penniless shoemaker from Port Hood. James's father fell in love with James's mother while measuring her feet. He promised her father he wouldn't take her far from home. He married her and took her to Egypt, and that's where James was born. Egypt was a lonely place way on the other side of the island, in Inverness County, and James never even had a brother or sister to play with. James's father traded his iron last for a tin pan, but no one then or since ever heard of a Cape Breton gold rush. It used to make his father angry when James and his mother spoke Gaelic together, for his father spoke only English. Gaelic was James's mother tongue. English always felt flat and harsh, like daylight after night fishing. But his mother made sure he was proficient as a little prince, for they were a part of the British Empire, and he had his way to make. One morning, the day before his 15th birthday, James awoke with the realization that he could hit his father back. But when he came downstairs that day, his father was gone, and his mother's piano had been quietly dismantled in the night. James spent 6 months putting it back together again. That was how he became a piano tuner. All James wanted at 15 was to belt his father once. All he wanted at 15 and a half was to hear his mother play the piano once more. But she was dead of a dead baby before he finished the job. James took a tartan blanket she'd woven and the good books she had taught him to read and tucked them into the saddlebag of the old pit pony. He came back in, sat down at the piano, and plunged into Moonlight Sonata. Stopped after 4 bars, got up, adjusted C-sharp, sat down and swayed to the opening of the Venetian Boat Song. Satisfied, he stopped after 5 bars, took the bottle of spirits from his mother's sewing basket, doused the piano, and set it alight. He got on the blind pony and rode out of Egypt. The Wreck Cove relatives offered him a job sending dories. James was meant for better things. He would ride to Sydney, where he knew there'd be more pianos. Sydney was the only city on Cape Breton Island, and it was many miles south, by a road that often disappeared. Along an Atlantic coast that made the most of itself with inlets and bays that added days to his journey. There were few people, but those he met were ready with a meal for a clean, clear boy who sat so straight and asked for nothing. "Where are you from, dear? Who's your father?" Mostly Gaelic speakers like his own mother. Yet always he declined a bed or even a place in the straw, intending that the next roof to cover his slumber be his own. Moss is the consolation of rocks, and fir trees don't begrudge a shallow soil, but return a tenfold embrace of boughs to shelter the skinny earth that bore them. So he slept outside and was not lonely, having so much to think about. Following the ocean a good part of the way, James discovered that there is nothing so congenial to lucid thought as a clear view of the sea. It aired his mind, tuned his nerves, and scoured his soul. He determined always to live in sight of it. He'd never been to a city before. The cold rock smell of the sea gave way to bitter cooked coal, and the gray mist became streaked with orange around him. He looked way up and saw fire-bright clouds billowing out the stacks of the Dominion Iron and Steel Company. They cast an amber spice upon the sky that hung, then silted down in saffron arcs to swell, distend, and disappear in a falling raiment of finest ash onto the side of town called Whitney Pier. Here, homes of many-colored clabbered bloomed between the blacksmith's shops and the boiler house of the great mill. And here James got a fright, never having seen an African except in books. Fresh sheets fluttered from a line. James guided the pony onto asphalt, across a bridge, where he looked back at the burnt brick palace a mile long on the waterfront, and contemplated the cleanliness of steel born of soot. Plates of tracks, a whiff of tar, to his right a dreadful pond, then onto Pleasant Street, where barefoot kids kicked a rusty can. He followed the screech of gulls to the esplanade, where the wharfs of Sydney Harbour fanned out with towering ships from everywhere, iron hulls bearded with seaweed, scorched by salt, some with unknowable names painted in a dancing heathen script. A man offered him a job loading and unloading. "No, thank you, sir." New rails in a paved street mirrored cables that swung along overhead and led him to the center of town. An electrical train carriage sparked and clanged right behind him. The sun came out. Charlotte Street. Fancy wood facades rose 3 stories either side. Ornate lettering proclaimed cures for everything. Glass panes gloated there was nothing you could not buy ready-made. McVeigh, McCurdy, Ross, Rhodes, and Curry. Moore, Mackenzie, McLeod, Mahood. McCutcheon, Vitelli, Boutillier, O'Leary, McGillivray, Ferguson, Jacobson, Smith, MacDonald, MacDonald, MacDonald. More people than he'd ever seen. Dressed better than Sunday, all going somewhere. He saw ice cream. And at last, up the hill where the posh people lived. The pony sagged beneath him and cropped the edge of someone's fine lawn as James came to the conclusion of his traveling thoughts. He would have enough money to buy a great house, for ready-made things and a wife with soft hands, for a family that would fill his house with beautiful music and the silence of good books. James was right. There were a lot of pianos in Sydney. His left eye. The first time James saw Materia was New Year's Eve, 1898, at her father's house on the hill. James was 18. He'd been summoned to tune the Mahmood's grand piano for the evening celebration. It was not his first time in the Mahmood house. He'd been tending their Steinway for the past year, but had no idea who played it so often and so energetically that it needed frequent attention. The piano was the centerpiece in a big front room full of plump sofas, gold-embroidered chairs, florid carpets, and dainty-legged end tables with marble tops. A perpetually festive chamber, even slightly heathen to James's eyes, with its gilt mirrors, tasseled drapes, and voluptuous ottomans. Dishes of candy and nuts, and china figurines of English aristocracy covered every surface. And on the walls were real oil paintings, one in pride of place over the mantelpiece of a single cedar tree on a mountain. James would be let in the kitchen door by a dark, round little woman, who he initially assumed was the maid, but who was, in fact, Mrs. Mahmood. She always fed him before he left. She spoke little English, but smiled a lot and said, "Eat." At first, he was afraid she'd feed him something exotic and horrible. Raw sheep. An eyeball, perhaps, but no. Savory roast meat folded in flatbread. A salad of soft grain. Parsley and tomatoes with something else he'd never before tasted. Lemon. Strange and delicious pastes. Pickled things. Things wrapped in things. Cinnamon. One day he arrived to find Mrs. Mahmood chatting in Gaelic with a door-to-door tradesman. James was amazed but glad to find someone with whom to speak his first language. Since he knew few people in Sydney, and, in any case, Gaelic speakers were mostly out the country. They sat at the kitchen table, and Mrs. Mahmood told him of her early days in this land, when she and her husband had walked the island selling dry goods from a donkey and 2 suitcases. This was how she had learned Gaelic and not English. Mr. and Mrs. Mahmood had made many friends, for most country people love a visit, the mercantile side really being an excuse to put on the kettle. Often the Mahmoods carried messages across counties from one family to another. But good news only, Mrs. Mahmood insisted, just as she did when she read a person's cup. "I see only good." So when she peered into the tea leaves at the bottom of James's cup, he was neither frightened nor skeptical, but felt himself drawn in with an involuntary faith, which is what faith is, when she said, "I see a big house, a family. There is a lot of love here. I hear music, a beautiful girl. I hear laughter, water." When the Mahmoods had saved enough, they had opened their Sydney shop, which thrived. Mr. Mahmood had bought his wife this splendid house and told her to stop working and enjoy her family. And yet, James never saw a sign of the family. Her children were all at school, and the big boys were at the shop with her husband. Mrs. Mahmood missed her Gaelic friends in the country and looked forward to grandchildren. She never spoke of her homeland. On this New Year's Eve day, Mrs. Mahmood greeted James with Bliana Ma'ur, but didn't show him into the front room, remaining in the kitchen to work alongside the hired Irish girl, who had a lot to learn. He proceeded there by himself, quite comfortable now in this house, took off his jacket and got to work. He had already removed a few ivory keys and was bent under the lid behind the piano's gap-toothed smile, so he didn't see Materia when she stepped into the archway. But she had seen him. She had spied him from her upstairs bedroom window when he came knocking at the kitchen door below, toting his earnest bag of tools, a blond boy so carefully combed. She had peeked at him through the mahogany railings carved with grapes as he entered the front hall and hung his coat in the closet beneath the stairs, his eyes so blue, his skin so fair, taut and trim, collar, tie, and cufflinks, like a china figurine. Imagine touching his hair. Imagine if he blushed. She watched him cross the hall and disappear through the high arch of the big front room. She followed him. She paused in the archway, her weight on one foot, and considered him a moment. Thought of plucking his suspenders. Grinned to herself, crept over to the piano, and hit C-sharp. He sprang back with a cry. Immediately, Materia feared she'd gone too far. He must be really hurt. He's going to be really mad. She bit her lip. He clapped a hand over one eye and beheld the culprit with the other. The darkest eyes he'd ever seen, wet with light. Coal-black curls escaping from two long braids. Summer skin the color of sand stroked by the tide. Slim in her green and navy holy angel's pinafore. His right eye wept while his left eye rejoiced. His lips parted silently. He wanted to say, "I know you." But none of the facts of his life backed this up, so he merely stared, smitten and unsurprised. She smiled and said, "I'm going to marry a dentist." She had an accent that she never did outgrow, a softening of consonants, a slightly liquid R, a tendency to clip not with the lips but with the throat itself. What she did for the English language was pure music. "I'm not a dentist," he said, then rushed pink to his ears. She smiled and looked at the loose piano teeth scattered at his feet. She was 12, going on 13. Had she hit E-flat, things might never have progressed so far. But she hit C-sharp, and neither of them had any reason to suspect misfortune. They arranged to meet. He wanted to ask permission of her mother, but she said, "Don't worry." So he waited for her, shivering on the steps of the Lyceum, until he saw her come out the big front doors of Holy Angels Convent School across the street. The other girls spilled down the steps in giggling groups or private pairs, but she was alone. When she caught sight of him, she started running. She ran right into his arms, and he swung her around like a little kid, laughing, and then they hugged. He thought his heart would kill him. He'd had no clue what it was capable of. His lips brushed her cheek. Her hair smelled sweet and strange. An evil enchantment slid from him. The salt mist coming off Sydney Harbor crystallized in the fuzz above his lip and alighted on his lashes. He was Aladdin in an orchard dripping diamonds. She said, "I got 5 cents. How about you, mister?" "I have $78.04 in the bank, and a dollar in my pocket, but I'm going to be rich some day."
"Then give me the dollar, Rockefeller."
He did, and she led him to Wheeler's Photographic on Charlotte Street, where they had their picture taken in front of a painted Roman arch with potted wax ferns. He felt, before he learned anything about where she came from, that the photograph had made them one. They continued on to Crown Bakery, where they shared a dish of Neapolitan ice cream and melted their initials onto the window. He said, "I love you, Materia." She laughed and said,
"Say it again."
"I love you."
"No, my name?"
"Materia." She laughed again, and he said, "Am I saying it right?"
She said, "Yes, but it's cute. It's nice how you say it."
"Materia."
And she laughed and said, "James."
"Say it again."
"James."
It was when she said his name in her soft, buzzy way that his desire first became positively carnal. He blushed, convinced everyone could tell. She touched his hair, and he said, "Do you want to go home now?"
"No, I want to go with you."
They walked to the end of the old pier off the esplanade and looked at the ships from all over. He pointed. "There's the Red Cross line. Someday I'm going to get on her by and go."
"Where?"
"New York City."
"Can I come with you?"
"Sure." She really was betrothed to a dentist, promised when she was 4. The dentist was still in the old country, but was coming to marry her when she turned 16. "That's barbaric," said James.
"It's old-fashioned, eh?"
"Do you like him?"
"I never met him."
"That's so. Backward. That's savage."
"It's the custom."
"What does he look like?"
"He's old."
"For God's sake." They walked back up the old pier hand in hand. To the right of them sank the tepid sun, while to their left the blast furnaces of Dominion Iron and Steel erupted into a new day's work. A light orange snow began to fall. Sydney is only small. By then, several people had seen them together, and word reached Mrs. Mahmood, who kept it from Mr. Mahmood. Materia was forbidden to have anything to do with the piano tuner. She was cross-examined.
"Did he touch you? Are you sure?"
And the nuns were alerted. She was never alone, and at night her mother locked Materia's bedroom door. Materia had been just 6 when they docked in Sydney Harbor, and her father said,
"Look, this is a new world. Anything is possible here."
She'd been too young to realize that he was talking to her brothers. On the night of her 13th birthday, Materia climbed out of her window and left the old country forever. "Come with me from Lebanon, O my sister." February 17th, 1899. A moonless night. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. They set out before dawn on a hired horse and got married that day at Irish Cove, in a Protestant ceremony performed by an ex-Navy chaplain who asked no questions in exchange for a quart of rum. "Thy lips, O my bride, drop as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under thy tongue." They snowshoed in to a hunting cabin on Great Brador Lake that was used by rich Americans in the fall. "Thou hast ravaged my heart, my sister, my bride." It was all boarded up, but he set to work. "Thou hast ravished my heart with one of thine eyes." Prying planks off windows, healing the blind. Inside, he wouldn't let her open her eyes until he'd swept, lit a fire, and laid the table. He'd thought of everything. There was rosehip wine, new linen sheets, and the mothbally tartan from his late mother's hope chest. "And the smell of thy garments is like the smell of Lebanon." He sang her a Gaelic lullaby, which made him cry, because, if such a thing was possible, he loved her more in his mother tongue. "A garden enclosed is my sister, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. He kissed her so gently, didn't want to frighten her. He'd mail-ordered what every husband should know, but decided never to touch her in that way if necessary. He'd rather die than frighten or hurt. She reached up and stroked the back of his head. "Habibi," she whispered. "Behebak." With my own hands, I opened my love. On the second day, she said, "Let's live here forever. Let's never go anywhere except New York City." And he said, "Don't you want a lovely big house and fine, handsome children? And to have your parents say, 'Well, you were right all along, Mrs. Piper.'"
"No."
Rolling over to lie on him, her elbows on either side of his face.
"I want to stay right here for a long, long time."
Curving her belly against him.
"Forever and ever. Kiss me with the kisses of your mouth. And ever and ever."
He sighed. When he came out of the woods for provisions on the third day, James was seized by two large men and taken by cart to Sydney and the back room of Mr. Mahmood's dry goods emporium on Pitt Street. Mr. Mahmood sat on a pressed-back wooden chair, a long, narrow man with leathery cheeks and black, wavy hair. "Sir," said James. Mr. Mahmood had splintering brown eyes. James looked for materia in them. "Sir," said James. Mr. Mahmood raised his forefinger slightly, and the two younger men removed James's boots and socks. James noted with some distaste that they both of them could use a shave.
"Where's my wife?"
Mr. Mahmood took a leather thong and whipped the soles of James's feet, so that for days they swelled and peeled and leaked like drenched onion paper. They put him in the YMCA and brought him meals. When he could walk again with the aid of a cane, the two men escorted him to the Sacred Heart Roman Catholic Church.
"Take your hands off me," James said.
But he hadn't heard either man speak a word of English.
"Oily bastards," he said.
Materia was waiting for him alone at the altar, veiled in black. She wouldn't look at him. Her hair had been cut off. They exchanged vows once again, this time before a priest of Rome. It was James's first time in a Catholic church. "Smells like a whorehouse," he thought, though he'd never been in one of those either. At the back of the church, Mrs. Mahmood's heart broke. Because how could that pale boy with no family and no real religion possibly know how to treat a wife? It's a terrible thing for a mother to know that her daughter will not have the happiness she herself has had. But more than that, more than sorrow, was a chill, for she had seen something in his cup. Mahmood didn't beat his daughter, and he counted it a weakness that he'd never been able to bring himself to raise a hand to any of his girls, for there was the root of the problem. The day after the horrible wedding, he instructed his wife to purge the house of materia. He went to his shop and sealed himself in his back room, while Mrs. Mahmood burned, snipped, and bundled off his daughter's memory. Materia's favorite little sister, pretty Camille, cried for days. She and Materia had dreamed of marrying two handsome brothers. They would live side by side in big white houses, and their children would grow up together. Materia would brush Camille's beautiful straight black hair every night, and they'd share a room just like always. Camille wrote a letter to Materia in large, neat printing with X's and O's at the bottom. But Pa found it and burned it. He called Camille to him in the cellar and beat her. It wasn't so much that the piano tuner was Inglis, or even that he was not a Catholic or a man of means. It was that he had come like a thief in the night and stolen another man's property.
"And my daughter yielded."
There was a word for all this in the old country.
Aib.
There was no translation. People in this country couldn't know the depth of shame. Of this Mahmood was certain. There was no taking her back. She was ruined. But God is merciful, and so was Mr. Mahmood. He allowed James to convert to Catholicism in exchange for his life, and Mr. Mahmood arranged for a good-sized house to be built for the newlyweds, 9 miles up the coast near Low Point. This was so he wouldn't have to toss them from his doorstep a year from now when they turned up destitute. Such a thing would kill his poor wife.
As for the yellow-haired dog who stole my daughter, may he rot. May he awaken to the contents of his mouth strewn across his pillow, and may God devastate his dwelling. Well, perhaps not the dwelling. As for my daughter, may God curse her womb.
The night after Materia's horrible wedding, Mrs. Mahmood opened her rosewood jewelry box. Immediately, the little ballerina popped up and began to revolve to the strains of the anniversary waltz. Mrs. Mahmood peeled back the red velvet lining from the bottom and placed there her daughter's long black braid, coiling it flat. She covered it with the velvet and replaced the beautiful things her husband had given her over the years, rubies, diamonds, moonstones, and pearls. Then she went into the big oak wardrobe where he would not hear her, and mourned. Materia never saw her family again. Her father forbade it. Her younger sisters were taken out of school and kept home till they were married. Materia's older brothers were forbidden to kill the English bastard, but all the same, he had better keep out of their way. She was dead to them all from that day forth. James and Materia moved into their big two-story white frame house, with attic, a month later. But just because it was new doesn't mean it wasn't haunted. Low Point. What James resented most was that Unclis nonsense. He wasn't English. Not a drop of English blood in him. He was Scottish and Irish, like 90% of this godforsaken island, not to mention Canadian. Filthy black Syrians. "Lebanese," said Materia. "What's the difference? You're better off without them." There was no town or village at Low Point. There'd been small mines around here, some dating back to the first days of the French, but they were all closed up now. Though scratch anywhere and you'd find coal. The closest neighbor was a Jew who raised kosher meat, and James kept his distance. God knows what rituals involving chickens and sheep. In the back of the house there ran a creek that emptied into the ocean half a mile away. The Atlantic was always in sight, and this was something James and Materia both came to depend on. If you followed this creek, you'd walk through long pale grasses keeled over in the damp, careful not to stumble on the rocks that sleep and peep out here and there, past a stocky evergreen or two, their spiky scent, beaded sap stuck with rain. Startled by the scarlet mushroom, you might stop and stare, or bend to feel the purity of the stream, refresh your eyes upon the pebbles stained with iron gleaming on the bottom there. Then you'd come, with your wet shoes and droplets in your hair, to a dirt road that stretches 9 miles to Sydney on the left and all the way to Glace Bay on the right. Some called this Old Lingan Road, and others called it Victoria or Old Low Point Road, but in time it came to be simply the Shore Road. You might cross this road and walk a few steps to the edge of the cliff. Down below is the jagged water. All day it chatters back and forth across the gravel beach, unless the weather's rough. Farther out, it's mauve like a pair of cold lips. Closer in, it's copper-green, gun-gray, seducing seaweed to dance the seven veils despite the chill, chained to their rocks by the hair.
And there on the cliff you might sit with your legs dangling even on a flinty winter day, and feel soothed by the salt wind. And if you were like Materia, you might look out and out and out, until what there was of sun had subsided. And you would sing, though you might not sing in Arabic. In time, Materia wore a path from the two-story white house along the creek across the shore road to the cliff. They didn't have much furniture at first. James bought an old upright piano at auction. In these early days, Materia would play, and they'd sing their way through the latest "Let Us Have Music for Piano." Sometimes she'd slide down the bench and insist he play, and he would, with gusto, the first few bars of some romantic piece, and then stop short, just as he did when he tuned pianos. Materia would laugh and beg him to play something right through, and he would reply, "I'm no musician, dear. I'd rather listen to you." He built her a hope chest out of cedar. He waited for her to start sewing and knitting things. His mother had milled her own wool, spun, woven, and sewn, a different song for every task, till wee James had come to see the tweeds and tartans as musical notation. But the hope chest remained empty. Rather than make Materia feel badly about it, James put it in the otherwise empty attic. He wasn't much of a cook, but he could boil porridge and burn meat. She was young. She'd learn in time. On weekends, he tuned pianos as far away as Manadoo. Weekdays, he cycled into Sydney, where he swept floors at the offices of the Sydney Post newspaper in the morning and worked as a sales clerk at McCurdy's department store in the afternoon. Then he'd buy groceries, cycle home, make supper, and tidy the house. Then prepare his collar and cuffs for the following day. Then climb the stairs and fold his dear one in his arms. One day in spring he asked her, "What do you do all day, my darling?"
"I go for walks."
"What else?"
"I play the piano."
"Why don't you plant a little garden? Would you like me to get you some hens?"
"Let's go to New York."
"We can't just yet."
"Why not?"
"We have a home. I don't want to just run away."
"I do."
He didn't want to elope for a second time. He wanted to stay put and prove something to his father-in-law. He intended to pay for this house. He started going to school every night by correspondence with St. Francis Xavier University, liberal arts. He knew that could lead to law, and then he could go anywhere. He had his mother's best-loved books, her Bible and her Shakespeare, Pilgrim's Progress and Sir Walter Scott, all well-worn, but he knew there were gaps to be filled in if he was to become a cultivated man, a gentleman. Books were not an expense. They were an investment. He spotted an ad in the Halifax Chronicle and sent to England for a crate of classics. He worked at the Sydney Post, but he read the Halifax Chronicle to get a perspective on the world outside this island, the real world. The hacks at the Post thought he was just a broom boy, and those unctuous Philistines at the store thought he was lucky to have a collar and tie job, what with no family and no one to recommend him. He'd show them, too. Not that they were worth showing. One evening that spring, he pried the lid off a packing crate and removed untold treasure, book after beautiful book, Dickens, Plato, the Oxford Book of English Verse. He paused over the latter, weighing it in his hands. "Just read that cover to cover," thought James. "You could go anywhere, converse with the Queen." Treasure Island, The World's Best Essays, The Origin of Species. He counted them. There were 12 in the crate. That meant he now possessed 16 books. "Just imagine," thought James, "all that knowledge, and it's here in my house on the floor of my front room."
He sat cross-legged and surveyed the riches. Which to open first? Their gilded leaves and their crimson covers engraved with gold invited him. He went and rummaged in the kitchen, returned with a pair of scissors. He selected a volume and lifted its front cover. The spine crackled, sending a shower of red flakes into his lap. No matter, it's the words inside that count. He took the thin blade of the scissors and carefully cut the first pages. He called to Materia. She was about the house somewhere, but he hadn't seen her for an hour or two. "Materia!" he called out again as he cut the last page. When she appeared, he said, "Where have you been, my darling?"
"The attic."
"Oh? What were you doing up there?"
"Nothing."
He didn't pursue it. Maybe she was up there, secretly sewing something for the Hope chest, planning to surprise him. He smiled fondly at the thought and said, "You look right pretty."
"Thank you, James."
Her hair was freshly braided and wound about her head, and she wore a rosebud print with puffed sleeves, matching ribbons and a hooped skirt. "Look, my dear," he said, "here's a book you might enjoy."
"Let's go out."
"Out where?"
"To town, to a dance."
"But, sweetheart, we can entertain ourselves for free right here, and you'll see, it'll be more fun." He gave her a warm smile and drew her down next to him on the horsehair sofa. He put an arm around her and turned to page one of the beautiful volume. He read aloud. "Book one. Of shapes transformed to bodies strange, I purpose for to treat." Savoring the words and the warm weight of his wife cuddled close, "Then sprang up first the golden age." He read, and evening closed in. "Men knew no other countries yet than where themselves did keep. There was no town enclosed yet with walls and ditches deep." He read, and the coals cooled to gray in the hearth. Reaching over to the lamp and raising the wick, he remarked to his wife, "Now, isn't this better than going out among strangers?" And turning to her for confirmation, he saw she was fast asleep. He kissed her head and returned to the book. "Of iron is the last, in no part good or tractable." He continued aloud because that was how he and his mother had read together, and the thought made James's happiness complete far into the night. "Not only corn and other fruits for sustenance and for store were now extracted of the earth, but eft they gan to dig, and in the bowels of the earth insatiably to rig for riches, couched and hidden deep in places near to hell." By midsummer, she was 3 months pregnant and crying all the time. James couldn't figure it out. Weren't women supposed to be happy about something like that? He tried to be extra nice. He brought her sweets from town. He tried to get her to read so they'd have something to talk about. He was at first amazed and then dismayed by her indifference to books. He assigned her a chapter a day of Great Expectations in order to cultivate a love of reading, and at supper time he quizzed her. But she was a sorry student, and he abandoned the effort. He racked his brains to devise some sort of seemly diversion for her, having given up hope that she'd take to housewifery. But it was no use, and he tried not to judge her too harshly. She was young, that was all. And yet it tried his patience. "Materia, you can't spend all your time wandering the shore and fooling around on the piano." For lately she'd begun playing whatever came into her head, whether it made sense or not, mixing up fragments of different pieces in bizarre ways, playing a hymn at top speed, making a B minor dirge out of Pop Goes the Weasel, and all with the heavy hand of a barrelhouse hack. James found it disturbing, unhealthy even. Besides,
He couldn't study with that racket.
I'm sorry, James.
Why don't you play something nice? At which she struck up the Maple Leaf Rag, and he yelled at her for the first time. She laughed, pleased to have gotten a rise. He decided to ignore her after that, which made her cry again. But, frankly, he'd figured out her tricks by now. She was just looking for attention. On Labor Day, he turned down an invitation to bring the wife and come to a McCurdy employee boat ride and picnic. He told himself he had no desire to socialize with ready-made gentlemen. It was enough that he worked beside them. If he once gave himself the spurious comfort of a social life, he might get sidetracked. But deep down, he winced at the thought of showing materia to anyone. He was grateful they lived in the middle of nowhere. It wasn't that he didn't love her anymore. He did. It was just that recently it had struck him that other people might think there was something strange. They might think he'd married a child. By September, she had puffed up and turned sallow. He began sleeping on a cot by the kitchen stove. "It's for your own good, my dear. I don't want to roll over and gouge the baby with an elbow." Pound, pound, pound on the piano keys in the middle of the night. No wits anymore, however juvenile. No naughty ditties, just discords. Tantrums. Fine. Let her exhaust herself. Plank, splank, splunk into the wee hours. In the mornings, he would rise from his kitchen cot as though he'd slept perfectly well, pack his own lunch, pat her on the head, and cycle off to work on iron tires. By Halloween, she was big as a house. One evening, he came home to find her sitting at the kitchen table with a bowl of molasses cookie dough, for that was what the ingredients lined up on the table indicated. He was delighted. Her first attempt at cooking. He even gave her a kiss to show just how pleased he was. But when he went to dip a finger in the dough, the bowl had been licked clean. "What in God's name are you doing?" She just looked queasily straight ahead. "Answer me." She just sat there, bloated. "What's wrong with you? Don't you think? Haven't you got anything to say for yourself?" The blank stare, the flaccid face. He grabbed the bowl. "Or are you just a lump of dough?" No answer. "Answer me!" He hurled the bowl at her feet, and it broke. She ran outside and threw up. He watched her hunched and huge over the back steps. You'd think by now she'd know enough not to bring it on. A dumb animal knows not to make itself upthrow. Well, she can stay out there till I've cleaned up this mess. He swept the floor and scrubbed it, too. He got a lot of work done that evening, not to mention some clear thinking. He locked the piano and pocketed the key. Then he said, "I'm not cooking anymore, and I'm not cleaning. You do your job, missus, 'cause Lord knows I'm doing mine." She looked so sad and dumpy. He had a pang of pity. Did all women get this ugly?
"I'm sorry, James,"
she said and started crying. At least it was better than that weird staring she'd been at lately. He let her hug him, knowing it would calm her. He didn't want to be cruel. He hoped the child would be fair. Materia went upstairs to the attic. She knelt down, opened the hope chest, and inhaled deeply. James thought Materia hadn't filled the hope chest because she had nothing to put in it. But she kept it empty on purpose, so that nothing could come between her and the magical smell that beckoned her into memory. Cedar. She hung her head into the empty chest and allowed its gentle breath to lift and bear her away. Baked earth and irrigated olive groves, the rippling vale of the Mediterranean, her grandfather's silk farm,
the dark elixir of her language, her mother's hands stuck with parsley and cinnamon, her mother's hands stroking her forehead, braiding her hair, her mother's hands, the smell of the hope chest, the cedars of Lebanon. She stopped crying and fell asleep. The Jewish Lady. Mrs. Lvovitz had seen the pregnant woman sitting on the cliff's edge, like a fixture warning ships, or luring them. People around here believed in kelpies. Mrs. Lvovitz's imagination had been infected. What could you expect with so many Catholics? They saw omens in everything. Where Mrs. Lvovitz came from, they called them golems. Maybe there's something wrong with the woman, thought Mrs. Lvovitz. Maybe she's simple. Because when Mrs. Lvovitz had passed by on the shore road to Sydney with her cartload of eggs the other day, she had heard the woman singing what sounded like nonsense words. A poor, simple-minded woman from down north in the hills, perhaps. They marry their cousins once too often. But as yet Mrs. Lvovitz had never seen the woman's face, for she always wore a plaid kerchief that had the effect of blinkers. Mrs. Lvovitz had asked her husband, Benny, if he'd seen the pregnant woman, but he never had. "Mr. Lvovitz, you must have."
"I haven't, Mrs. Lvovitz."
"She's there every day."
"Maybe she's a ghost."
"Get out, Ben."
Benny laughed. He knew her weakness. Mrs. Lvovitz had resolved to speak to the woman next time, because by now she was beginning to suspect she'd been all too Celtified. She needed to satisfy herself that the woman was human and not an omen. If an omen, it was important to determine certain things. "When do I usually see her? In the morning or evening?" A forerunner seen in the morning meant death that was still a ways off. Seen in the evening, it meant get ready. A child meant the death of an innocent. On this day, Mrs. Lvovitz was driving the shore road from Sydney as usual, having sold all her eggs.
"A dozen Jewish eggs, please."
She could hardly keep up. Likewise, Benny, who delivered meat in his icebox wagon.
"Hello,"
said Mrs. Lvovitz, pulling up her horse. The bright kerchief fluttered in the sea breeze. It was a nice day, but that could mean anything.
"Hello there,"
Mrs. Lvovitz repeated.
"Hello, hello,"
cried little Abe beside her. The plaid kerchief turned, and Mrs. Lvovitz said to herself, "Gott in Himmel!" A pregnant child. A dark little thing, too. She must be from away, or from Indian Brook, maybe. Mrs. Lvovitz forgot all about ghosts and golems.
"Where are you from, dear? Who's your mother?"
Falling into the local formula.
"I haven't got a mother."
"Get in the cart, girl."
It was surprising to find out that the child belonged to that big new white house across the way. Mrs. Lvovitz had never seen her come or go, just appear, as it were, on the cliff.
"How old are you?"
13 3/4. "Ay, ay, ay, and married to that young fella."
It was illegal, of course. Where did he get her? A child bride. From overseas somewhere. Was she Italian? A gypsy? What was the accent? Mrs. Lvovitz made tea and entertained these and other questions. All would be revealed, she'd see to that, but first, tea. Where she came from and where she lived now, tea meant a spread. She placed a plate of cookies before Materia, who said,
"What's that?"
"What do you mean, what's that? That's rugula."
Materia took a bite of the folded-over cookie. It tasted strange and familiar all at once, cinnamon and raisins.
"It's good," said Materia.
"Of course it's good."
Materia turned her attention to little Abe, playing peekaboo.
"Where's your family, Mrs. Piper?"
I haven't got one. You can call me Materia.
What's your maiden name?
Mahmud.
For God's sake, everyone knows the Mahmuds.
Ibrahim.
That was my father.
And Giselle?
Materia nodded. Mrs. Lvovitz remembered when the Mahmuds used to sell from a donkey, hampers swaying on each side. Hard-working people. They did what we all hoped to do. Now there is the big dry goods store in Sydney.
So what are you saying? You've got a family. They're your family.
Materia shook her head. I don't belong to them anymore.
Why not?
I'm dead.
You're dead? You're not dead. What kind of crazy nonsense is that, I'm dead?
It's a custom.
I know from the custom.
Sitting shiva for your own flesh and blood while they're alive and well. Such a custom is better left in the old country.
Drink your tea, Mrs. Piper.
You can call me.
And eat. You're eating for two. Eat.
Mrs. Lvovitz taught Mrs. Piper to cook.
What's this? Asked James.
Chicken soup with matzah balls.
He looked at the bland sponge floating in broth, broke off a fragment with his spoon, ate it. After all, not so different from a tea biscuit dunked in soup.
This some kind of Arab delicacy.
Jewish.
They weren't the first people he would have picked as friends for his wife, but, after all, it wasn't as though they were sacrificing babies over there. And she had finally started acting like a wife, even if the results were on the heathen side. James figured it was just as well the neighbors were foreign. It wouldn't occur to them that there was anything strange about his being married to such a young girl. And what did he care what a Hebrew farmer thought of him, although Mr. Lvovitz seemed like an all-right type? James had gone over there to make sure.
Call me Benny. Benny, taste this. What is it?
Looked like a plug of McDonald's Twist.
Taste it. Mmm. You like that? Not bad. It's good. I smoked that myself. You want? I'll sell you a whole cow for the winter. Fresh off the hoof. Pick one. They're all good.
Nothing really strange about the Jew except the accent, his black beard and curly sideburns and his little cap. James bought half a cow.
I don't want it kosher, said James. What do you mean, it's kosher? I butcher it, it's kosher. I don't want you to do anything funny to it. Don't worry, you'll see that cow. Yeah, that's the one I'm saving for you. That's a Presbyterian cow. I'm Catholic.
Benny laughed. James smiled. Compared to Materia's family, the Lvovitzes seemed downright white.
1900. At the 11th hour in her 9th month, Materia began looking forward to her baby. That's because she'd grown to love Abe Lvovitz, who was 2, and Rudy, who was 6 months. She wanted a son, of course. Her father would be hard-pressed to disown a first grandson, even if it came to him through a daughter. That was what she told herself. And then she could see her mother again and her sisters. She'd be a good woman after all. She began to pray to Our Lady, "Please, dear Mary, let it be a boy." James named the baby Kathleen after his late mother. Kathleen wasn't the first baby of the new century, but she was near enough so that James had to pelt all the way to Sydney on the old nag and drag the doctor from the dregs of a New Year's party. They arrived back at Low Point in time for the doctor to